Zionist activists.
People's ability to grasp what exactly is happening to the Palestinians is determined by what they read about it. What they read about it is dictated by those who write it. Today we take a close look at how key figures at the most prominent British newspapers are influenced by the Israel lobby. The Daily Mail, together with its website, The Mail Online, are estimated to reach 4.1 million people on a daily basis. Very few are aware that its longtime city editor, Alex Brummer, is actually an Israel lobbyist. Simultaneous to his job at The Mail, he is also the chair of the Israeli regime-funded Abraham Initiatives, which claims in its trustees report that it advances synergy between Israeli bodies and respective agencies and institutions in the UK. Sounds like a lobby group, right? Well, here he is at Israel Lobby Group BICOM's We Believe in Israel event. Listen to what he says.
We need BICOM, we need the toolkit, and we need it urgently because, you know, there's a tide of opinion which has turned against Israel, and it's going to be very hard to turn it back.
The Sun newspaper is estimated to have a daily readership of 3.7 million and is owned by Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation Group. We know that in 2007, the News Corp Foundation was listed as a funder of the Jerusalem Foundation, which builds in Israeli settlements. Murdoch himself also serves on the board of oil and gas exploration company Genie Energy. Genie Energy has been granted contracts by the Israeli regime in the illegally occupied Golan Heights of Syria. But what about the journalists at The Sun? Trevor Kavanagh, former political and later associate editor of The Sun, has a very close relationship with the Israel lobby group BICOM. He spoke at several We Believe in Israel events in support of the faction, and when he was criticised for lamenting what he called the Muslim problem in the UK, Israel lobbyist and part-time journalist Alex Brummer leapt to his defence. In the aftermath of Protective Edge, Kavanagh willingly stepped forward at a We Believe in Israel event that I chaired to staunchly make the case for Israel's actions and to criticise media bias. The Guardian is widely thought to be the progressive alternative to these right-wing class war rags. However, what we find is a newspaper which has been subjugated significantly by the Israel lobby. It has a daily readership of 3.5 million, and Jonathan Friedland was an executive editor there between 2014 and 2016, during which he also spoke at several BICOM events, including one named the UK-Israel Shared Strategic Challenges Conference, where he lovingly hosted a conversation session with current Israeli President Isaac Herzog. He has also spoken at events for the New Israel Fund and has his work publicly supported by the Israeli Embassy in the UK. Sounds too close for comfort. Lastly, but never least, is the touchstone of the British establishment, the Times newspaper. It has a daily readership of almost 500,000 people. Brownman Maddox was the foreign editor of the Times, simultaneous to being a non-executive director of the Chatham House think tank, which is funded by the Israeli embassy. She later went on to be an editor of Prospect magazine, and simultaneously to that, hosted current Israeli Foreign Minister Yair Lapid, a part of the UK-Israel Shared Strategic Challenges Conference. Today, Maddox is the director of the Institute for Government think tank, which is funded by the Israeli government, and also Lord Sainsbury, who has pumped over £1 million into the Labour Friends of Israel lobby group. This is simultaneous to Maddox writing for the Financial Times, naturally. So here we have evidence of British newspapers with a collective daily readership of almost 13 million, being staffed by people with what seems to be quite serious conflicts of interest. Nothing to see here.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic on Israel. He's also a co-founder and co-director of a lobbying watchdog initiative, Spinwatch. We're also joined by Dr. Ramzi Baroud. He's a journalist and the editor of the Palestine Chronicle. He's also authored 5 books. His latest one is called These Chains Will Be Broken, Palestinian Stories of Struggle and Defiance in Israeli Prisons. Ramzi is a non-resident senior research fellow at the Center for Islam and Global Affairs in Istanbul. And he joins us from Seattle, where it's very early in the morning. Welcome to the show. David, if I could just to start with you. Now, I've heard a lot about this sort of propaganda network pushing certain lines in the media. Where's that directed from, do you think? And are there specific organizations behind it? And how is it being organized?
Well, you see these journalists who, if you like, are Zionist infiltrators in the media. And really, we should think of them as being that kind of character. They're not journalists who happen to have sympathies. These are people who are infiltrating on behalf of a hostile foreign state, the State of Israel. But there are also a number of other ways in which the State of Israel tries to influence the media in this country. Of course, there's the government, the State of Israel itself, which has its own propaganda and public relations apparatus, but they also have a number of organizations in this country which are known usually as pro-Israel lobby groups. BICOM has been mentioned in the film there, and it's the main PR agency in favor of Israel in this country. People think of it, as I said, as an Israel lobby group, but of course it's really an arm of the Israeli state. It functions very closely with the embassy and indeed with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, also with the Ministry of Strategic Affairs when it was in charge of anti-BDS activities in this country. So when you hear people at BICOM speaking, really what you're hearing is the messages that come from Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. You're not hearing some independent British Zionist organization. You're hearing the views of a hostile foreign state. And that's the important thing here. And what's important about the understanding propaganda networks is that they are there to direct particular sorts of messages which the infiltrators in the media, the journalists who happen to be Zionists, will pick up and spread.
Mm. Ramsey, I wonder if we could come to you now, if we can get you up on the screen. I wonder if you could maybe tell us about the situation in the media in the United States. And I mean, is this a problem, do you think, with the individual rogue Zionist journalists, or is it a systematic problem, do you think?
Of course, it's a very much a systematic problem. In fact, the United States kind of pretty much define the genre of media bias, and they kind of brought it down to a science, more or less. On the one hand, you have this very idea of the very normal Israel. Israel is not being examined or not being tested in any way. Israel defines the narratives on democracy, on normalcy, on civilization, on human rights, and it's constantly in a state of self-defense. Now, this is not something that has happened overnight. It's an institutional propaganda that goes back many, many years, particularly after the war of 1967, and even in the early 80s with the rise of powerful lobby groups like AIPAC and others. While Palestinians are constantly being portrayed as the enemy, being portrayed not just as an enemy of Israel and therefore enemy of democracy and civilization and human rights, but also the enemy of everything that America stands for, the so-called American values. So in other words, the Americans have gone several steps ahead of everyone else in the West, which is linking the United States interest with American interest, and therefore Palestinians are seen as not just at odds with Israel, but also at direct odds with the United States, with its policies, and with, again, so-called American values.
So clearly a major issue there, then, that you're setting out, Ramsey. And yet we hear about these situations like the columnist, what was her name, Barry Weiss, resigning from the New York Times, alleging anti-Semitism. She even talked about a new McCarthyism. I mean, what do you make of that?
Well, if we think about it in terms of superstructures, if you think about Israel's presence in the United States media, academia, and of course, government and foreign policy, you would find that they have created a new normal in which any form of criticism of Israel is not even allowed to be discussed, dissected, or anything. So in their mind, they feel like this is the normal. This is the status quo of thinking on this particular subject. Any deviation from that thinking, that for us is outrageous because it does violate all norms of fact-checking, good journalism, good common sense. But again, for them, it's a generational issue. Any criticism of Israel, be it, for example, emphasizing the latest human rights Watch and Amnesty International reports on Israeli apartheid and violations of human rights in Palestine. Just the mere mention of that is considered an act of anti-Semitism as far as the pro-Israel camp is concerned. So in other words, they are very spoiled in terms of their expectations, and they actually have no idea that they have already checked all the boxes and they have everything they want to have in terms of the dominance of their narrative over any others when it comes to Israel and the Middle East.
I mean, David, one of the worst outlets for this problem in the UK, certainly, and I think it's actually distributed in the United States as well in any event, is The Guardian. Maybe you could say a little bit about The Guardian. I mean, what's happened to The Guardian? I mean, it used to be kind of seen as a, you know, kind of radical newspaper that sort of championed free speech, but it seems to have lost the plot, doesn't it?
Well, The Guardian has a long, long history of cozying up to imperial power and to the British state, but it had a period where it was more liberal, where it was able to do more investigative journalism. Of course, in recent years, they shut down their investigative journalism unit. And under the influence of someone like Jonathan Friedland, who of course is very strongly connected to the Israeli government, the Guardian has become much more pro-Israel and much less receptive to any kind of criticism of the state of Israel. They have a number of journalists in there who are in that kind of position. The chief political correspondent, for example, Jessica Elgott, who has risen from nothing, from working at the JC some years ago through the Huff Post, and into this role in The Guardian. She was on record recently at a Board of Deputies meeting saying that nobody should use the term Zionist. It's not allowed to use the term Zionist. And this is at the cutting edge of current Israel lobby thinking, that we can criticize the Israeli government, but we cannot use the word Zionist, and we cannot criticize the Zionist movement, which means, of course, we cannot criticize the actual activities of the Israeli government in this country. So someone like Elgott is clearly an ideologue for Zionism, but has this position in The Guardian, which is very senior, where people aren't really aware that there's a fundamental problematic nature to her approach.
Mm. I mean, we've heard a lot about BICOM, haven't we? I mean, it's often described as a sort of a pro-Israel group. I mean, would you say that's true, or are there more concrete links with the Israeli embassy?
Well, there are very concrete links with the Israeli embassy, indeed with the State of Israel itself, and indeed with the so-called Israel Defense Forces. The current head of BICOM is in the reserves of the Israel Defense Forces, which is an extraordinary situation. So when you hear BICOM speaking, and any of the people who speak on its platforms, like we've seen in the video there, what you're hearing is the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and the Prime Minister's Office and the Israel Defense Forces speaking. This is straightforwardly an arm of the Israeli state.
Right. Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there for a moment, because we have another report looking at the apparent purge against Palestinian and Arab journalists in the German media.
Germany has a reputation for its refusal to allow open debate on the occupation of Palestine. But recently, disturbing signs of a purge of Arab journalists has emerged. Deutsche Welle is a publicly funded international broadcaster active in 32 languages. It is specifically regulated to be independent of government.
And I think it is time for the people of Germany and German elites to stop making Palestinian children in the Gaza Strip pay for the crimes of the German people against European Jews.
This all began in May 2021 when DW's English language division interviewed Electronic Intifada journalist Ali Abu Nima.
Palestinians are sick of paying the price for guilty German consciences.
The interview prompted an internal crisis at the broadcaster, which issued a public apology and a set of internal reporting guidelines specifying that Germany's path in carrying out the Holocaust means it has a special responsibility towards Israel. The memo banned its journalists from describing Israel as an apartheid state, a description affirmed by Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and Israeli human rights organization B'Tselem, and advising against the term colonialism. In June 2021, Matthias Duffner, chairman of the German publishing house Axel Springer, who describes himself as a non-Jewish Zionist, told employees who objected to raising the Israeli flag on the building's headquarters to find another job. In December last year, DW suspended its cooperation with Jordanian media partner Roya TV, following the emergence of allegedly anti-Israel comments published on social media by the broadcaster. But recently, the climate became more and more restrictive. In February of this year, seven journalists were fired and the head of news in the Arabic service resigned. All were Arabs, six of them Palestinian. The journalists resolved to take legal action. But it emerged that the investigation report allegedly compiled by experts had been written by individuals with serious conflicts of interest. One in particular was the Palestinian Ahmad Mansour. Mansour is a hardline Islamophobe, given to referring to Arabs as, quote, savages. He has worked with a hardline Likudnik think tank, the European Foundation for Democracy in Brussels, and is a staff member at the Zionist Intelligence-Connected Interdisciplinary Center in Herzliya, occupied Palestine. Palestine Declassified can also reveal that a Deutsche Welle social media editor, Polina Gareev, who has been in post since April 2021, had a previous role in the Zionist entity as news editor of the official IOF magazine, Bamahan. In addition, the current Middle East editor at DW is Jennifer Hollis. Previously at the Zionist lobby group, the Israeli-Swiss Association, in occupied Jaffa. Deutsche Welle has trashed its own reputation and shows no sign of independent reporting on Palestine. It's well known that Germany is a hostile place for the Palestinian cause, but recent events emphasize the need for fundamental reform of journalism and the media.
David, I wonder if you could first off start by telling us a little bit about this social media guru. What was her name? Polina Gareev, I think I've pronounced her name correctly.
Yes, so this is something which we have discovered that I think even the journalists who were sacked at Deutsche Welle weren't aware of, that she had previously worked for the IDF's own magazine, a magazine set up prior to the creation of the State of Israel for the Haganah, the armed group which was involved centrally in the Nakba. She also works, I think, for the Israel Policy Institute, which, of course, is funded directly by the Israeli state. And this is an extraordinary conflict of interest, and, of course, not one which the German media will be likely to pay much attention to, but which throws a great deal of light on the way in which these journalists have been so shoddily treated. So I think that's a really significant thing. It's the same situation as we've found, effectively, in the British media, that there are Zionist infiltrators, effectively, throughout the mainstream media. And Deutsche Welle, I remember, is a public broadcaster, like the German equivalent of the BBC World Service. It's supposed to be independent of states. And they've sacked all these journalists, seven journalists sacked, one of them resigned. And they've got these other people in there, like Polina and several others, who used to work directly for the Zionist movement or the Israeli state. Extraordinary.
Talking about conflicts of interest, what about this character Ahmad Mansour that was mentioned in the film? He seems to have a very significant conflict of interest, doesn't he?
Well, we come back again, don't we, to the same issue we had with the British media, which is that there is this network of hawkish think tanks which are pushing people forward to be experts in the media, which are issuing statements and which are, you know, trying to infiltrate the media institutions themselves. I mean, the connections he has there with the European Foundation for Democracy, which is a hard-line Likudnik think tank in Brussels, which is funded almost entirely by the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies in Washington, D.C., which is itself, as admitted by the Ministry of Strategic Affairs in Israel, an asset, an agent, effectively, of the government in Jaffa. So there's a real issue there. He's also been associated with the IDC, the Interdisciplinary Center in Herzliya, which, of course, has a strong connection to both elite special forces in the IDF and indeed to the Israeli intelligence services. Something like 20% of places are reserved for such people to go to this university. So this is a person who is well connected straight to the Israeli state and who is performing a role of a kind of state-sanctioned Islamophobe, going around condemning Arabs as savages and trying to suggest that Arab journalists are anti-Semitic. Now, there's no such thing going on here. What we're seeing is an attempt to intimidate and occupy public service broadcasters and indeed the private press to make sure that there can be no criticism of the state of Israel.
And Ramzi, I mean, obviously the situation in Germany is pretty dire. I mean, do you think that the United States is more open to dissent on Palestine maybe than Germany is?
Well, I think there are the historical sensitivities that are at work in Germany makes the nature of the conversation there, I mean, stifles it all together. And you know, what the points that Ali Abu Nu'aymah raised is really something quite serious, and they have to be considered, and they have to be at the core of this discussion. But of course, that is just simply impossible in Germany. And I personally experienced in both Germany and Austria particular situations in which, you know, I had talks canceled, venues canceling on me last minutes. In one particular visit to Austria, four different venues canceled on me, and we had to scramble into a cafe shop last minute to bring people there to speak about Palestine. So the very idea of discussing Palestine within a sympathetic point of view in these countries is problematic. So this is something that goes beyond media into civil society, into academia, and into other venues. Now, in the United States, is different business. Again, because you have this massive infrastructure of think tanks that have been at work for a long time, particularly after 9/11 also, we have kind of seen this amalgamation of narratives where basically Israel became an American platform to fight terrorism, so-called terrorism, and the way that Israel played so very well on this particular aspect. You have characters, for example, like Daniel Pletschka from the American Enterprise Institute, one of many institutes, but people like her, her connections and friendships with Netanyahu and other members of the U.S. Israeli government, but also her relationship and connections to the American ruling elites, particularly within the neoconservative movement. And we know how the neocons and the Israelis have worked so very well together. And yet when they appear on American media, whether Fox or CNBC or even CNN, they are not seen as people who represent Israel per se or Israeli point of view. They come across as normal, concerned American intellectuals, academics, analysts, and they offer a point of view that is supposedly uncorrupted by these kind of sinister connections. And this is what we really have to deal with here at quite often. I mean, you might find this is quite strange, but when I first came to the UK years and years ago, I was actually impressed with how British media once in a while allowed some kind of a Palestinian or sympathetic Palestinian voice, to the point that my British friends would say, "What are you talking about? They are ridiculously biased." And of course, it took me time to understand that within the British context. But the reason I felt that is here in America, we are completely erased. We are completely marginalized, to the point that if you are, as a Palestinian or a pro-Palestinian voice, to get published in a respected American newspaper, you would have to watch everything you say. You would have to water down your language to the point that almost the language becomes emasculated. And in fact, this is the reason of why I veered off completely in a sort of chasing after the Washington Post and the New York Times to publish an article once a year or two or three. You know, we invested more in alternative media, because that's really the only way that you can reach even the margins of American audiences and society. But it is far more beneficial and rewarding process than actually try to get the American media to pay any heed to your point of view.
We're going to have to leave it there, I'm afraid, Ramsey. But thank you very much indeed. Unfortunately, we are out of time. We could have gone on, obviously, for a lot longer. Thank you very much indeed for joining us today. We'll be back next week with more news and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In the U.S., new details from evidence cited in the indictment of Enrique Tarrio, the former head of the far-right Proud Boys, reveal a plan with similarities to what unfolded at the Capitol on 6th of January 2021. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Alan Feuer. The piece is titled, Document in January 6th Case Shows Plan to Storm Government Buildings. A document found by federal prosecutors in the possession of a far-right leader in the United States contained a detailed plan to survey and storm government buildings around the Capitol on 6th of January last year, people familiar with the document said on Monday, 14th of March. The document, titled 1776 Returns, was cited by prosecutors last week in charging the far-right leader Enrique Tarrio, the former head of the Proud Boys extremist group, with conspiracy. The indictment of Enrique Tarrio described the document in general terms, but the people familiar with it added substantial new details about the scope and complexity of the plan it set out for directing an effort to occupy six House and Senate office buildings and the Supreme Court last 6th of January. The document does not specifically mention an attack on the Capitol building itself, but in targeting high-profile government buildings in the immediate area and in the detailed timeline it set out, the plan closely resembles what actually unfolded when the Capitol was stormed by a pro-Trump mob intent on disrupting congressional certification of President Joe Biden's Electoral College victory. Many questions remain about the document, including who wrote it and how it made its way to Enrique Tarrio, according to prosecutors, on 30th of December 2020, as President Donald J. Trump was engaged in a series of overlapping schemes to keep himself in power. The people familiar with the document said other evidence the government has gathered suggests that it may have been provided to Enrique Tarrio by one of his girlfriends at the time. Prosecutors have not accused Mr. Tarrio of using the document to guide the actions of the Proud Boys extremist group, who played a central role in the Capitol attack. Nor do the charges against him offer any evidence that he shared the document with his five co-defendants: Ethan Nordine, Joseph Biggs, Zachary Rail, Charles Donahue, and Dominic Pozzola. But the document could help explain why prosecutors chose to charge Mr. Tarrio with conspiracy, even though he was not at the Capitol during the attack on 6th of January 2021. And it appears to be the first time that prosecutors have sought to use evidence of a specific written plan to storm and occupy government buildings in their wide-ranging investigation into the attack and what led up to it. Enrique Tarrio's lawyer, Nayab Hassan, declined to comment. Broken into five parts: infiltrate, execution, distract, occupy, and sit-in, the nine-page document recommends recruiting at least 50 people to enter each of the seven government buildings and advises protesters to appear unsuspecting and to not look tactical, the people familiar with the document have said. After ensuring that crowds at the buildings are full and ready to go, the document suggests that leads and seconds should enter and open doors for others to go in, causing trouble to distract security guards if necessary. Should the crowds fail to gain entrance to the buildings quickly, the document suggests pulling fire alarms at nearby stores, hotels, and museums to further distract security guards or the police, the people have said. It then says protesters should occupy the buildings and conduct sit-ins, even recommending slogans for people to chant like "We the People" and "No Trump, No America." The document also makes suggestions for the days leading up to the 6th of January 2021, the people have said, advising protesters to scope out road closures near the seven target buildings. On the morning of the protest, they added, the document suggests having scouts drive around the buildings to look for roadblocks. While much of the document is marked for internal use, the people said it contains a section known as the Patriot Plan that appears to have been meant for public distribution. This part of the document suggests that crowds begin to gather at the seven buildings at 1 p.m. on 6th of January 2021, the people familiar with the document have said. 30 minutes later, the public part of the plan calls for the crowds to await a signal from lead and then to storm the buildings. The indictment of Enrique Tarrio, who recently stepped down as chairman of the Proud Boys extremist group, was a significant development in the Justice Department's sprawling investigation of the Capitol attack, and the second time in recent months that charges had been brought against the leader of an extremist group that played a prominent role in the assault on 6th of January. In January, prosecutors indicted Stuart Rhodes, the leader of the Oath Keepers militia, with seditious conspiracy for what the government has described as a plot to violently disrupt the work of Congress. Altogether, more than 30 Proud Boys have been charged so far in connection with the Capitol attack, and many more took part in it, but have not been charged. Members of the group, who have long served as vocal and often violent advocates for Donald Trump, were instrumental in several key moments in the riot, including one at the Capitol's security perimeter that resulted in the first breach of the barricades. Prosecutors are still investigating the group. In court papers filed last week, they said they had recently carried out search warrants at the homes in North Carolina and central Pennsylvania of two top members of the group. Those members were later identified as Jeremy Bertino and John Stewart, according to people familiar with the matter. Unlike many of his subordinates, Enrique Tarrio was not in Washington on 6 of January 2021, having been arrested 2 days earlier for vandalizing a Black Lives Matter banner at a black church in the city after a pro-Trump rally in December of 2020 that spiraled into violence after nightfall. Charged with a second crime, the possession of 2 high-capacity rifle magazines, he was ordered to leave Washington, D.C. by a local judge as part of his release agreement. But federal prosecutors said in their indictment that although Mr. Tarrio was not accused of physically taking part in the breach of the Capitol, he nonetheless led the advance planning and remained in contact with other members of the Proud Boys extremist group during the storming of the building. Prosecutors have claimed, for example, that Mr. Tarrio issued orders before the attack for members of the group to leave behind their traditional black and yellow polo shirts and remain incognito when they arrived in Washington, D.C. In the days leading up to the 6th of January attack, Mr. Tarrio also took part in a private Telegram group chat with other Proud Boys called the Ministry of Self-Defense and appeared to watch from a distance as several leaders and members of the group stormed the Capitol building, prosecutors have said. Arrested last Tuesday in his hometown of Miami, Florida, Enrique Tarrio is expected to appear in court there on Tuesday for a hearing to determine his bail. On Monday, prosecutors released court papers recommending that he remain in custody and arguing that he encouraged his compatriots to press on even as they broke into the Capitol. "Proud of my boys and my country," Enrique Tarrio posted on social media not long after lawmakers were chased from the building, delaying the final certification of the presidential election. Around the same time, prosecutors have said, a member of the Proud Boys posted a message in an encrypted chat asking, "Are we a militia yet?" Enrique Tarrio responded with a one-word voice note. Prosecutors have said, "Yep."
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim. Din al-Islam, din al-Islam, din al-Islam, din al-Islam.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We're going to talk about, in fact, some of the rules related to fasting and Ramadan, since we are in the month of mercy, in the month of Barakah and in the month of Ramadan. So we're going to deal with this. In fact, according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei, but before that, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching Makassas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that. Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Chabit, our guest speaker in the studio with us. Well, we are talking about some of the Islamic laws related to Ramadan, according to Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Chabit, let me start off this episode with this question. Imagine this scenario that there is a woman and her husband who are seriously sick and physically weak. Nevertheless, both of them fast. Sometimes it is quite evident that, you know, fasting aggravates their health and their illness. Can you guide us concerning the rule that applies to their fasting? Is their fasting valid?
Well, that's a good question. You know, many people feel, ill or unwell during the month of Ramadan, and they would like to know whether it's permissible to fast or carry on fasting or not. You know, the criterion in determining the inability to fast or whether fasting causes illness or, let's say, aggravates the illness or, let's say, hampers the quick recovery of the individual who is suffering from illness, you know, this is an opinion, you know, this has to be decided by the individual himself, you know. The person himself knows, no one else is a better, you know, source of understanding than the individual himself. He can look at his condition or his ability, whether he is able to fast, whether he is sick, whether he's okay to fast, or whether fasting has a negative effect on his poor state of health or not. In the event that he feels that fasting actually hampers his progress, his becoming better and better, then he should not fast, because health comes first. You have to give more importance to your health rather than to fasting.
I see.
And if you are not healthy, what is the use of fasting? So you have to observe fast. And of course, if a person has genuine fear that fasting will cause illness or will damage his health or will be injurious to his health, he should not fast, and fasting will not be valid.
I see. Sheikh Javid, you know, when you're talking about ill people or sick people and patients, they go to doctors and they sometimes get the doctor's prescription, and in order to improve their bodily health, they need to listen to the doctor's order and obey the doctor's prescription, right?
Yeah.
So regardless of the fact that whether these physicians are Muslim or believers, or they are, let's say, aware of the Islamic laws or not, they sometimes give out those prescriptions. So what is the responsibility on the part of the patients here in this regard if a doctor, in fact, forbids them fasting?
You know, if the physician's statement makes the patient confident that fasting is harmful for him, or he fears of harm in fasting, you know, there are two scenarios. So either, you know, the fear is there either on the basis of the physician's statements or on some other reasonable grounds, then of course it's not obligatory for him to fast. Rather, it can be said that it is not even permissible for him to fast, because he is confident on the because of the fact that the doctor advised him not to fast, and now he is confident enough. In the event that an individual is confident, or he has genuine fear that maybe fasting will have a negative effect, of course he cannot fast, and it will not be permissible to fast.
I see. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh. Let's take a short break and we'll be back. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on Arabi English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the Islamic laws based on Ayatollah Khamenei and in the month of Ramadan, and related to the month of Ramadan and fasting. Well, Sheikh Javid, you know, if some people are suffering from kidney stones, and in order to, let's say, avoid the stones to get bigger and bigger, they need to prevent it from calcifying in their kidneys. So, and they are usually told by the doctors and the physicians to consume a lot of fluids and a lot of water, as the doctors have, let's say, prohibited, in fact, those individuals from fasting. What is their duty regarding this blessed month of Ramadan?
Well, if the treatment of illness, you know, depends, or let's say requires, that you drink water and consume fluids during the day, then it's not obligatory for you to fast, you know, because you have to take care of your health first, and health comes first. So you have to drink as much water as you are as you can to, let's say, to protect your kidney and to, let's say, get better. So if drinking water during the day is necessary, you should drink water and take care of your health.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay. Likewise, diabetics are somehow required to take insulin injections once or twice a day, depending on, in fact, the severity of their cases. Also, their meals should be or should not be delayed and taken at long intervals, all right?
Yeah.
Otherwise, they might get into a coma or get fits. This is why physicians advise them, Sheikh Javi, to have 4 meals a day sometimes.
Yeah.
So would you please shed some light on their validity of their fasting?
You know, if you know that abstaining from eating and drinking from dawn to sunset is going to be harmful to your health, so or maybe you fear, because sometimes you are not sure, you do not know for sure. So you have genuine fear that maybe, if you stop eating or if you restrain yourself from eating and drinking, you are going to suffer. So in this case, obviously, fasting is not obligatory.
Mm-hmm.
And it will not be, permissible for you to fast. Now, generally speaking, it is not permissible for an individual to fast if fasting is going to be injurious or harmful to your health. And even if it is not, if you do not know that, fasting, if you mm-hmm. have that fear, it is enough. And if, fasting is going to, let's say, hamper or slow down the recovery,
yes,
then again, it's not permissible. You might recover sooner or later, but fasting might slow down the process of recovering.
Mm-hmm.
Then in that case, again, it's not permissible to fast.
I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid, for your nice contribution to this program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio. Thank you, my dear audience, for listening to this program, especially in this blessed month. So please keep us in your prayers and supplication. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم من جاء إلى
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.